The Off the Ball Podcast Network. Wednesday night rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Ireland play in the Kobe Stadium tomorrow against Russia. Ronan O'Gara on the line. Evening.
Hiya, Joe. How you doing?
Very well. So who said the group stages were going to be boring?
That's the understatement, isn't it?
It sure
who
is.
Who said that Japan wouldn't be a threat? Wow.
Wow is the word. I presume you watched that second half in a semi-state of shock as things unravelled.
Yeah, I did actually. Even the first half was... Obviously, Ireland were in control, but just from an early stage in the game, you could see that Japan looked like a completely different team to the team we saw in the first game. And I think just the way they moved the ball was very impressive. So when you kind of get that early on, you're kind of going, hold on a sec. Incredibly impressive was the capacity to keep the ball alive.
So it's hard to know where to start when you analyse the Irish performance. What we can say in broad terms, first of all, is at the very least there is now an inconsistency about this Irish team which is completely confusing. It's hard to know what's going on from game to game and even sometimes within games at the moment.
Yeah, that is a very accurate way of describing it. I think, look at Scotland, and because Ireland were so clinical and so efficient and so ruthless, it became a non-match for a long time, and they managed the game from probably 40 minutes, and they just, for the first 40, they just actually demolished Scotland. And then 7 days later, was it, or 6 days later, it looked like Ireland were chasing Japan around the pitch after probably a really structured, impressive 25 minutes.
What do you think happened?
I think what happened was that Ireland gave Japan the lead and went to play. And if you do that against a team like that, they will play. And you could see how efficient they were clearing out rocks and getting moving, the point of attack and challenging Ireland in different areas. And usually then what happened, as you said, within a six-day period where Ireland were very aggressive defensively, I thought they were the opposite against Japan. And if you give teams like Japan time and space, a team that all of their players would be aware of, or have played in super rugby conditions. That's what it felt like watching an open game. And if you want to play an open game, Japan aren't the opposition to be trying to play an open game against. So from that point of view, I think they massively missed the structure that Johnny Sexton brings to games.
Yeah. Regardless of Sexton's presence or not, which we'll come to in a second, surely there was enough on the pitch in terms of leadership and experience at some point to say, this game is way too open. This is the wrong team to be open against. Let's dial this right back and play structured rugby. It's staggering, really, that didn't happen at some point.
I don't know. It's staggering. I've been there myself. I've quite experienced. I've made errors like that too, Joe. I think that's what happens when you're kind of playing and... circumstances that you're maybe not used to for 9 other months of the year. And I'm not making excuses, but that's what humidity does to you. That's what happens when your brain stops working to the point that you need it to work. And I think that's the benefit of watching and the coach and looking with a little bit of hindsight. But when you're stuck in that moment, it's very hard to change that. It's the exact same as, I think, when you don't win collisions at the start of the game and you give the opposition momentum. At this level, it's very hard to wrestle it back. It's the same as body language when you look at people, you know, how fatigued they were, how they're carrying themselves when the whistle goes. A lot of people on their haunches, a lot of people down. You could see that Japan, I think, edged Ireland in those little battles all over the pitch.
Joe Schmidt came out yesterday to say that for three of the four offside decisions against Ireland, World Rugby had told them that the wrong decision had been given, so Ireland were punished unfairly there. I mean, that may be so. I don't know, is that a great look to come out 2 or 3 days later and to be talking about decisions like that? Like, Ireland playing to their potential should beat Japan regardless of how many penalties go against them.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that too. But I think in the small print that Andy Farrell came out today and just said the point Joe was trying to make was that their discipline is normally really good and it's an area they take massive pride in and they set world standards in that regard. I think it might be interpreted as sour grapes, and I don't think that's the point. But the other side of that argument too, that it's unacceptable howlers from assistant referees. You know, Gar says calling two penalties for offside, which his bosses have proved were inaccurate. So you'd expect a little bit more top level of officiating. So I agree with you. I don't think it's Japan were a better rugby team on the day. Ireland at 80 minutes. For 30 of that, they were better. For the other 50, they were a long way second best. And, you know, I don't think any of us would have been complaining too much if Ireland hadn't secured a bonus point defeat.
Yeah. It is amazing, really, that Ireland didn't manage to score for the entire second half, you know, for starters. With the Irish attack, and you've been a defence coach, not least in France, and I'm sure it's an aspect of the game you're still looking at very closely. It's interesting. I'm just reading, happen to be reading Jamie Heaslip's book at the moment, and Gordon Darcy was writing about something similar today in his piece in the Irish Times, and they were both almost reminding me of the days where a Joe Schmidt attacking team, they, you know, you would talk about the animation of the players around the ball, and you would talk about the picture that they were presenting for the opposition defence as being very complicated and difficult and tricky for the opposition to work out. It didn't seem across that second half, albeit Japan had a lot of the ball, but when Ireland did have the ball, it didn't seem, and it hasn't seemed lately, like the picture that the Irish attack is giving the other team is causing them many problems or confusing them. Now, are you looking at the Irish attack in shape and the animation and all these things? Is it any different to what it was when it was really working and humming for Ireland?
I never thought about it like that. It's a good question. I would agree that they're, you know, I mean, of all the teams, I think to manage to deal with their attack, you look at the difference between the Scottish game and the Japanese game, and the Japanese completely made light work of our attack. It was staggering, really, to see that, I suppose, the ease with which they defended us. And as you said, we didn't score for the second half, but we didn't look too dangerous on many occasions either to score or too threatening or creating overlaps. Well, you flip it, and the way Japan were kind of clearing the points of attack, at times they looked like they had six men over at certain stages, but they actually deprived themselves maybe by sticking their own teammates with poor passes. So that's something, obviously, that Ireland would need to look at. Does it look different to, I think what worked against Scotland was the fact that there was, start of a World Cup, I would say, there was a massive fear factor, I think. There might have been an overreaction maybe to the fact that Ireland, everything was back on track after the performance against Scotland. How good were Scotland? I don't think they were adequate or good on the day, to be honest with you. And I think maybe there was a little bit of, now we're back, we'll show up and our game will work against Japan. But it didn't work against Japan, and they didn't have solutions on the pitch. And that's the beauty of sport, or the beauty of rugby. You've got that 80 minutes window to fix it. And if not, I think you've got to take it on the chin, like I suppose a lot of them have.
When was the last time you think the Irish attack looked really good and really caused a team problems?
Give me some games.
Well,
they need some games.
The Six Nations. So
World Cup warm-ups. Well, there was nothing happening in those games, really, in terms of the...
So Six Nations, we had England first up. We had the Italian game, which in Rome went very badly. You could argue it was a decent performance against France, maybe, but how good were France? And obviously in Cardiff against Wales, it was no good. And then, you know, against Scotland away, Carberry made that great breakthrough. But you know, that's a moment as opposed to a trend and, an attack causing routine problems across an 80 minutes. So I don't know, are we back to November?
It was the Scottish game. Ireland were sharp in everything they did. Sometimes you can get bogged down with patterns. And I think once you start talking about that, I think you've already lost what you're hoping to achieve. Because if you become a pattern-based team, then the instinct and excitement comes out of you. And maybe there is a little bit of that Joe is so good and the players have so much trust in his ability to deliver pictures that players need at this level to probably see things or to process decision-making in their head. Sometimes that happens for you if you have a little bit of oomph in your carry. And that's what Ireland had against Scotland. Everything looked very natural against Scotland. But against Japan, after 30 minutes, it felt to me that we just... probably lacked direction and lacked, I think, composure more than anything else.
You mentioned Sexton, so he would have been fairly crucial in all this, as you've referenced. We had Brian O'Driscoll on at the weekend, and he was sort of saying, I hope we haven't cut off our nose despite our face with Sexton, because some players should be given an exception, I suppose. And they asked Sexton, was he fit for the Japan game? Like a simple question, were you fit to play? And he said, well, I couldn't train fully Monday, Tuesday, so the call was made at that stage that I wouldn't play against Japan. And look, hindsight is everything. That decision probably hasn't aged brilliantly. And now we're at a point where the feeling is, well, he has to play tomorrow against Russia. He'll probably have to play against Samoa as well. And suddenly you're asking him to play three games in a row, maybe a fourth, who knows? We're probably getting very ambitious there, but three games in a row. And you just wonder his profile, can he do that?
Yeah, well, that's probably the better question. With his profile, can he do it? But there's no reason he can't be doing it. Look at Kieran Reid, you know, he's playing 80 minutes against South Africa. He's playing 80 minutes against Samoa. He's playing 80 minutes ever since he's come back with the Crusaders, I think. So that age isn't a barrier. I think a lot of these guys, they've probably don't have enough minutes of rugby in them. So I think you need to change your mindset about how you're delivering that message to players, because Ireland are going to need Johnny Sexton to be performing at the top of his game. But has he had the right probably conditions to prepare to be at the top of his game? I wouldn't be too sure, because the World Cup is a hard place to be starting form, and if you have 60 minutes going into it, it becomes even more difficult. And if you're 34, it becomes more difficult again. But I think there are the players, and especially a player of Johnny's mental capacity, he can do it. But the reality is, if Johnny was on the pitch against Japan, would Japan have won? They probably would have won, Joe. I think there's other 14 players that have a responsibility, or another 22 players as well. And it's not I don't think it ever comes down to the five injuries that happened in the last World Cup against Argentina. The deficit was still over 20 points.
Yeah.
So there's more to it than that, I would think. So in that regard, it's a massive, I would say, again, opportunity for these players, because they're being written off again. And they're the only people that can come up with this, but they can't turn it on their head. But I suppose history goes against them in that regard.
What's worrying you the most at the moment when you look at this team?
Nothing's worrying me in that regard, because I suppose from a selfish point of view, I'm kind of concerning my energy with what I'm doing.
Okay.
But if you were with the benefit of experience, you kind of, momentum is huge, and Ireland don't have momentum. And I think they needed that to probably give themselves a good chance in the quarterfinal, but they've lost it against Japan. But now, the great thing about it is we'll see who the real leaders are, and we'll see what this team is made of.
In 2011, Ireland beat Russia by 50 points. It was 62-12. Is this kind of no-win territory in some respects? They beat Russia by 20, 30, 40 points. It doesn't allay very much, does it?
Everything is geared for a quarterfinal assault for that game. That has to be the 80 minutes that really matters now. So there's kind of a 3-week prep for getting yourself right for that big game. And I don't think they can stutter and expect to win a quarter final. So I presume if you're part of that team, what you want to be doing is restoring confidence for this game and going up a level against Samoa, and then hopefully just putting it all out there for the quarterfinal.
By all accounts, this stadium is incredibly difficult to play in. There were 30 handling errors in the England-USA game. There were 35 in Scotland's game against Samoa. It's sticky. It's akin to actually playing with a wet ball. So that'll probably be a part of how Ireland go about their business, I would presume, tomorrow. Like, what would you class as a good result against Russia? I haven't seen very much of them. I don't know much beyond the fact that everyone says they're fairly rubbish.
Yeah, but they're one of obviously the weaker competition or teams in the competition. I think what I'd be looking at is obviously, I suppose, the body language and performance.
Okay.
I think the result is, as we all know, a byproduct of what you do. So I think they're going to be needed to get in. They're kind of pillars of performance or what they judge themselves on. And they want to be making sure that they can't obviously be as secure as they would be 18 months ago, and confidence can't be as high. But you'd hope that the confidence isn't rattled to the extent that you mean to absolutely stutter out of this competition. That would be desperately disappointing for everyone.
Yeah. A few players coming under a bit of the microscope. Peter O'Mahony is one of them. What are you seeing from him at the moment?
Well, he got a head knock against Scotland, so he didn't play much when he was on the pitch. He was, I thought he was impressive like every other Irish player that day. The last day against Japan, he had a quiet game. But I think, you know, that kind of ebbs and flows along experienced players when they come in and out of form. But it's important he stands up, because I think a lot of his peers will look to him to stand up. And I think he usually is a good... what's the word I'm looking for? He usually is a good indicator of where this team is at. Mm. Peter O'Mahony has the chest out and if he's kind of getting set first and he's leading the line out, and if he's, you know, I think abrasive around the breakdown and winning penalties and quick to his feet, I think that's a good indicator. But we didn't see that against Japan.
Yeah. One of the moments where you felt Saturday wasn't going to go the way Ireland wanted it was the line out on 50 minutes about 10 metres from the Japanese try line. And again, Rory Best and the line-out just not working at key moments as well. Like, as a coach, how much longer can you allow that situation to fester?
Sure, it was top-notch against Scotland.
Was it? I mean, there were two that they got very lucky against Scotland with.
Okay, yeah. Well, I didn't analyse it to that extent. Yeah, I just thought it was watching from a distance. I didn't analyse the line-out, so... Yeah, you're right. That's more of an accurate comment from you. I think it's another subunit, Joe, but I think it's very easy to pick holes in a lot of things, but I think sometimes you have to kind of have a look at the global vision or the global view of the game and see what... You know, if it's a campaign to remove Rory Best, there will be always voices and noises around that, I think, because of the fact that he's 37.
I don't know what the right answer is, actually. I'm not part of this campaign. I genuinely don't know. I can see it as a tough call at this stage, a big call.
But who would you start?
I don't know.
Yeah, see, so my view on that would be, I would think that, 95% of the big days for Ireland has been Rory Best at the helm, leading as a captain, leading as a hooker, leading as one of their forwards. Mm. I think my fear, and it might be a negative fear, would be the fact that I think Sean Cronin is excellent coming off the bench, and people will say, well, he starts every week for Leinster. Yes, he does, but it's up probably another two notches from club rugby, World Cup rugby is. And Niall Scannell is very good, but he would have nowhere near the experience. And what does that say? He's come in, and I think in the morning of the Italy game, and he's done really well as a late replacement, I think, when Rory was sick. And I think he has answered the call willingly on a number of occasions. But, you know, I think this discussion was probably had long and hard between the Irish management about the pros and cons of keeping Rory Best for a Rugby World Cup campaign. So yeah. I would say after a defeat to Japan, I would say it would potentially open an excuse avenue for the inexperienced players in the team.
Mm.
This is the time when you need to be tight, when you need to back each other, when you need to have trust, when you need to get out there. And actually, the margins are tiny, but actually, why not have the drive or the attitude to go at it? This can be turned around, but if you keep telling yourself it can't be, it won't be. It depends what attitude you take.
Yeah, well, I think they have, all the vibes are good coming from Japan. I suppose we're having a different kind of conversation here.
I agree. And this isn't a negative conversation.
It's negative enough now.
You're grumpy as usual.
I'm having to drag every inch of it out of here. Will you come on?
Now you're a serious sports broadcaster now, so, you know.
Can I ask you lastly then, Has anyone is anyone knocking on the doors to come in? Like, if you,
everyone, that is the absolute beauty of it from a whole squad point of view. That's a great question to ask.
Anyone in particular?
Now the pecking order is gone. There is no such thing. You know what I mean? I think the two probably players, I think there's Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton penciled in to play a quarterfinal. Rory Best will captain the team. Tadhg Furlong will play. James Ryan will play. The back row's too competitive. No centres. Keith Earls will play. And I don't know who else will play.
Hmm.
But that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, we'll end on a cheery note. How about that?
It's not too cheery, is it?
Well.
Your voice is despondent.
No, listen, it's cheery.
Okay, we can do this, Joe. We can do this.
We're going all the way.
We're going all the way, but some people are hoping we might lose to Russia or Samoa. I don't see that happening.
Hmm. Okay, well, I guess we'll talk before a quarter-final when there is always the chance that Ireland can still put together a big performance. That is eminently
possible.
But that's
the beauty of it. As you say, you don't know what's coming. That's not good for people's hearts and people's spirits, but you look what happened. The week is a long time in sport, and they've gone from pretty impressive performance to a no-show, basically.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep watching. Listen, thanks a million.
Cheers, Joe.
Good man.
Thank you.
Ronan O'Gara on the phone there. Our rugby coverage is with thanks to Vodafone, Team of Us, everyone in. Now, before we leave the rugby, we did catch up with Eoin Sheehan last night. He was out and about in Kobe enjoying the best steak around. And then today, he sat down with Rob Penny, former Munster coach. He's just been announced as the Waratahs' new head coach. And we're going to bring you Eoin's interview with Rob Penny in just a moment.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of Us. Everyone in.
Okay, I am delighted to say I am joined here by former Munster coach Rob Penny. Rob Penny, current Waratahs coach. Congratulations, Rob.
Thanks, Owen. Appreciate it.
How do you feel about this job? Is this something you've been eyeing up for a while? I saw you linked to the job about a month ago, so I presume it's been some time in the making.
Yeah, it's like all those sorts of positions. They take a wee bit of time to get a detail sorted out, but very, very fortunate to be in the mix and just wrapped to get the opportunity to coach back at super level again. And I'm really passionate still about the game and still about coaching, so hopefully we can really get that organization humming.
What's the thing you love most about coaching?
Well, I love the game first and foremost, and I love to see young men achieving their goals. So obviously there's a bit of I guess live my life a little bit vicariously through the actions of the players and get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing them achieve their goals, as I said. And there's a brand of rugby that excites me. It's when people are working hard and playing for each other and seeking space and, you know, showing their skills and exhibiting, I guess, the wider range of skills that the game allows players to show off in the right environment and the right context when everything's functioning well. And you get those, not those moments don't come along very often, but when they do, it's really special. And that's, I guess, what you're searching for as a coach, which what I like to try to search for as a coach is working on a strategy, developing the skills, developing the knowledge and the confidence and the ability of the boys to really challenge themselves and push on.
And would the Waratahs at the moment be an organisation that kind of fits that mould already?
Yeah, without doubt. Yeah. They are, historically, they've had a massive reputation of being a team that enjoys using the ball. They've had some, obviously, world-class players go through their organisation and have been at the forefront of a free-flowing brand of freedom of expression. And it's really embraced. And what's special, I guess, around the Sydney area is the climate is conducive to, you know, boys throwing a ball around.
Which brings me to my next point, the contrast between there and Ireland, where the climate is not conducive. It's interesting looking at, say, a team like Munster at the moment, where it is a Springbok in charge of the team, playing sometimes the Springbok way. In terms of your own philosophy, if you were to go in back as Munster head coach right now, would that be at odds with your own coaching philosophy?
I wouldn't have I wouldn't go into Munster and change my philosophy. Look, you look at people like Andrew Conway and Andy and Earlsey and you know, the front rowers tomorrow, and you know, they were all there and coming through when I was there, and you know, Killer's a really good ball player. Niall Scannell, he's a smart rugby player. John Ryan is a very, you know, a very good ball player, and the two boys on the edge, on the outside, Jesus, they're exciting. They're a great machine. So there's five of the lads, and obviously you've got Peter O'Mahony, who's been a massive stalwart for Munster and Ireland, all capable of playing a variety of styles. And that's obviously what you want. I mean, what you want is your ability to go, when the opportunity is there, to attack in a certain way. You want to have a skill set and a confidence and a knowledge to be able to attack that way. When your back's against the wall, when the conditions are difficult, you also want to be able to be proactive and just go, we're going to dominate this game through this aspect. But you don't want to be, you know, putting all your eggs in one basket all the time. Sure. I think that variety is the key. And, you know, it's just being, I guess, able to educate the players, give them confidence, and then unleash them with the confidence that, that they've got the ability to make those decisions and play a variety of styles.
It's interesting you say that. In the week that was, the analysis of Ireland after the Japan game, Andy Dunn was on the show with us during the week saying that it was a game that showed Joe Schmidt abandoning elements of his usual game plan, but it was the wrong time to do it. I'm not sure whether you go along with that analysis.
Look, Connor is such an important member, and you know, they shut down the fringe as well, and then when they got the ball, they sped the tempo up a bit, put the Irish boys under a bit of pressure. I wonder whether there's been a big dent in confidence after the English match. It just happened at a really bad time for the boys, and they crawled their way back, obviously, and had some good performances and outcomes against Wales, the lead-in. But I just wonder, after the, you know, that English performance, where that was obviously very challenging, there is a little dip in the confidence, and that tends to make teams go a bit narrower and hold on to the ball when possibly offloads are on, and then all of a sudden the pressure of that game sort of compound it. And, you know, there's an opportunity to learn massively from that, and Joe's smart, you know, we know that, and he'll be analysing what's required to make a shift. They get Sexton back in the 10, that'll make a massive difference. And, you know, I'm sure getting a good performance out of them tomorrow, and then down in Fukuoka against Samoa, and just depends on how Japan go and who plays who in the quarters. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that Ireland are going to get there, and it's just a matter of what sort of nick they are mentally in when that opportunity occurs.
It's interesting that you mentioned the confidence aspect, because when you look at Ireland's first 20 minutes against Japan at the weekend, particularly personified by Jack Carty, it looked like there was confidence oozing out of every single pore of every single player, and then it just disappeared. So I do wonder if you're onto something there, that there was just some sort of residual lack of confidence that sort of manifested itself midway through that first half.
It's such an important aspect of the game, you know. The Irish psyche is such that it's built around, I guess, the passion, but the passion generally is built on the negative aspects of life, you know, the underdog characteristic. And, you know, they came into this tournament as the world top ranking, and that probably didn't rest easy with a few.
No.
And that's a learning. That's a massive learning, you know, and I think Steve Hansen obviously alluded to that leading into the World Cup by throwing some grenades in about, you know, it's a different pressure being number one. So all those subtle little, you know, little nuances create a degree of pressure, and yeah, I'm sure though that they're dealing with it internally, and they just got to put that behind them. There's enough talent in there to really get back on track. They've got two games that they should win convincingly now and get that confidence level back. And as I say, it's going to depend on Japan really, who Ireland play.
It's interesting that you tap into the Irish psyche there, because you're actually probably better placed than anybody in Ireland to actually say it, because you've seen it from the outside looking in, you've been there for a while. Is it too negative sometimes, the way Irish people think, the way the media behaves, the way supporters behave?
Look, it's a fantastic little country. It's a lot like New Zealand in a lot of ways. It's almost small man syndrome, you know, like you want to be the underdog, and it gives you a bit of a motivation in a negative context. I do believe that there is some benefits in playing for the love of the game and for the joy and for the expression that allows, rather than these buggers hate us and we've got to smash them because we don't like them either.
Sure.
And as I guess I'm of a generation that played that way through, you know, hate the opposition. And as I came through my coaching career, it was very obvious, and it's the same in Ireland too, I found, is that because there's a much greater interaction between players socially, it's hard to say to a Munster boy that may have come from Leinster, we've got to hate Leinster. It just doesn't ring a bell, because he's a good mate with him and they play international rugby together. So there are elements of that don't work motivationally. And as we know, hate and anger are a very short-term motivator, whereas love is a very powerful long-term motivator.
Yeah.
So it's just about, I can't comment on the Irish psyche. I've got some great friends in Ireland still, and we communicate, and they often talk and, you know, take the piss out of themselves around that sort of stuff.
We're good at being self-deprecating.
Absolutely. Absolutely you are. And, you know, part of that is, you know, you've surrounded by some massive nations and very powerful nations, and, you know, you probably don't think of yourself in the same ilk as them, and it's just a bit, I'm not saying everyone, but it's just part of the Irish psyche, and when you're looking at it from the outside in, you do see that. And you know, it is part of what makes Irish special as well. Mm. You know, that there's no real cockiness, everyone's down to earth, genuine people.
Yeah.
lovely culture to be a part of. I was lucky enough to live there for a couple of years and loved it, but we're talking about motivation and long-term motivation, and there are elements that you know, I'm sure Joe's working hard to try to keep the boys up and excited and
confident. It's interesting that you mentioned the fact that, you know, Leinster players sometimes move to Munster or vice versa. It happens the way of the former more usually, especially at the moment. And Joey Carberry obviously moving to Munster was a big story, obviously, back home. Do you think that rivalry between Munster and Leinster gets eroded a little bit by migration of players from within their own province to a rival province?
No, I don't. I think, no, fundamentally. It's like, I guess, in a Southern Hemisphere context, it would be Canterbury, Auckland. We had a lot of Canterbury boys come to Auckland. A few went up there, but most of them came to us. The rivalry still is passionate and as vibrant as ever. And that, you know, Munster-Leinster, the games don't get any better. Like, having lucky enough to coach a couple of those, and just wonderful occasions. Those boys that come into Munster from Leinster, they get embraced, which is wonderful. They become Munster men very quickly. Mm. But, you know, they'll still have relations and friends up there and that we're dealing with. So, you know, within the team and the squad itself, it's just how you temper your language around making sure that you're not offending anyone with what you're talking about as you head into those big fixtures. And it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting few years for Munster. Like, after you departed, obviously you had the terrible death of Anthony Foley. It was a period of recovery after that, and then a couple of years later, or a year later, Razzy Erasmus getting poached by the Springboks, and now Johan van Graan is in. Like, a lot has happened at Munster since you've left. What's your take on where they are and the direction that they're going in as a province?
Yeah, look, tragic. Axel and his family. And I, you know, I really desperately hope that, you know, the boys are coping well. And but the I guess there's been a massive amount of exterior influences on the Munster environment that haven't helped with the continuity and the consistency. They've had some, obviously, some great input from Arassi, and he took them down a different path, well, a pathway. And after Axel departed, and Felix, you know, was a good, really good, young developing coach, and had reins on the attack. And now, obviously, Arassi and Felix have gone. Flannery's gone now as well, so there's another group of coaches coming in and having to re-establish. They've got off to a good start this year, though.
Yeah.
So that was positive. Ospreys, I think, was a good win the other night.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been easy, you know. And my thoughts go out to Garrett Fitzgerald as well. You know, like, he's been, you know, on the periphery a little bit for the last 18 months or so with his. Yeah. Little issues. So there's been there's been issues that they've had to deal with that have been out of their control and unfair, but also you know, they've coped pretty well. You know, they haven't fallen apart, and it shows they've still got great resilience.
You've obviously got fond memories of Munster, but when you think about Munster, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Oh, it's the people. There's no doubt. You know, there's a few special occasions at Tormund Park, but they revolve around, I guess, the special players that you remained in contact with and still have a bit of affinity for. And and it's great, you know. Tomorrow night I'm doing a bit of a call for Irish Radio and helping Mike on that, and there's five of the Munster boys that I had a lot to do with in the starting group. So I'm chuffed to be here to be able to watch them.
You get a sense of pride.
Oh, massive. I was only just a little passing, I guess, influence in their lives, but they're good boys, and it's great to see them now wearing the Irish jersey and with consistency and doing great things for the game in Ireland.
It feels like a silly question to ask because the Waratahs job is such a huge job and you're not thinking about anything after this, but what is your current dream job outside of Waratahs? Where do you see your career going and developing over the next couple of years? Are you looking to get into the international game?
Coaching's such an unusual job. You do what you do, and if you're lucky enough, other people recognise that you're doing something well, and then obviously opportunities will spin out of that, I guess. But I just focus on the job I'm given at the moment. I've been in Japan for 5 years. Really love my time here. It's been a special, a very special job and a special place to work. Never thought I'd come here, but once I arrived, it was just such a good fit. And then I was obviously now fortunate enough that somebody in the Super World thought I might be able to contribute and use the skills that I've learnt, you know, from my time in coaching, to be able to contribute to their environment, and I'm very excited about that now. And I'm just going to put my heart and soul into that. And I've got 3 years there, hopefully more, who knows, but we'll see where that leads. And, you know, if somebody at some point in time thinks that I could do a good job for them going forward, coaching's tough, you know. There's a lot of elements to it that people don't really understand the time and effort and energy that it takes to keep, you know, 30 to 40 young men on track, focused, and, you know, a dozen staff, and keep that harmony and unity, because you're in close-knit, I guess, environments for long periods of time. A lot of testosterone floating around. So the fire in me still burns strong to coach, and that's all I can say. I don't know what it'll be like in 3 years' time, but I'm lucky to be given the role that I've been given, and I'm whatever happens will happen.
You obviously leave Japan now. These are your last few weeks, I presume, in the country before moving abroad. What will this World Cup do for Japanese rugby? You've obviously seen it grow. You've been there after the Brighton miracle. You've seen the bounce it got, but that's probably all it was for a while. It was a bounce and kind of went back to base level again. But then this has brought a renewed energy to the tournament. A win against Ireland does do a lot to help as well. So what is the trajectory of Japanese rugby in your view?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it going more into a traditional professional league, which I think will do wonders. At the moment, it's all company driven. So there's a lot of semi-pro elements to the game here. There's some, there's some very good high-level professional rugby boys from foreign countries playing outstanding and contributing outstandingly well to the environment here. A lot of the Japanese boys work for half a day, then come into rugby for half a day. So that has its challenges. And obviously a lot of the boys are selected as employees as opposed to rugby players. So sometimes the teams, there's not the balance is difficult to get right. Salary caps, there's a salary cap here, but it's really irrelevant. Some teams, find ways to exceed what would be a salary cap to most of the teams. And the benefit of that is they get, to play for the trophies at the end of the competitions generally. So there's a little bit of inequity around the competition here. But in saying that, if it goes pro, which would be great, soccer did it 20 years ago and has been really successful. Basketball did it, I think, 10 or so years ago and has been really successful. So taking away, I guess, the control of the companies and putting a professional framework around the teams and the organisation is the way forward. Mm. One of the biggest issues here is where do the young kids play? There's not a club structure as such. The high school and universities are very, very powerful and have massive influences into the Japanese hierarchy and decision making, but it's not in the best interest of the players.
Right.
And it was interesting. I was talking to Tim Horan yesterday, actually, without name dropping, but and he was saying that he got asked to go along to a university training run, and there was 120 boys, and he was asked to just run a training run. Well, it's impossible without many staff to run a quality session. You can do some broad stuff, but nothing really meaningful. But that happens, 5 days a week at most universities, 120 boys running around with one head coach and maybe a couple of support staff. And, there's better ways it could be done.
Sure.
And, even the top league, I think in the 6 years I've been here, well, this is my sixth year, we've had five changes of domestic competition structures. There's opportunities here to really embrace the game. And as you say, on the back of this World Cup, Japan really need to take it by the horns and drive some major changes. Mm. It means there'll be a power struggle, but it's in the best interest of the game, no doubt. And if they get that right, it could be a really flourishing time for Japanese rugby.
How are Ireland going to get on at this World Cup, in your view? Where are they going to finish?
Oh, look, they'll be in the mix. Jeez, we know, we've seen in past World Cups, and we've seen again with the Japan fixture against Ireland, that there are a lot of teams capable of beating each other on the day. I think it'll come down to probably the big four, you would think. New Zealand, South Africa will be there, England. And then it's who's going to work their way through. I just see, watching a bit of France, USA at the moment, France 12-6 up and really struggling. But they can, as they've proved before, they can just turn that on its head with a performance and rip through to that top four, and then who knows? Ireland will obviously be there or thereabouts. Australia, it's a tough one to pick, this one, because of the lead-in competitions and the amount of changes there's been in personnel across all the international sides. No certainty, which is a good thing. Mm. Which is a good thing. But Ireland will be there or thereabouts, I'm sure.
Do you back them at all against, say, the All Blacks in a World Cup quarterfinal? Basically, I'm asking you, do you think the All Blacks are going to win the World Cup?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how as we alluded before, how Ireland bounced back after the performance last week. Look, they'll be full of passion and they'll be full of friggin' emotion. But are they going to be confident enough to push the ball when it needs to be pushed? And are they able to take that into a massive game like a quarterfinal against New Zealand and be confident that the ball's going to stick?
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it?
It is exactly it. That's what it'll come down. It'll be small moments, but I'd back the All Blacks to take a small moment ahead of most of the other sides just at the moment.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. Rob, it's been fantastic catching up. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Very best of luck with the new job and congratulations once again.
Thank you very much.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.